This time on Come Receive the Light, we're going to talk about Christology. Do you know what that is? Well, it's a deep theological study of Christ.
Christology is important because if we do not follow the correct teachings about Christ, then we have no way of being united to Christ.
Author James Kelly takes us on a journey this week into the content of one of his many books, this one entitled A Realism of Glory.
I would say that for the Orthodox, the glory is the love, life, and presence of God that comes down directly into the heart of man. And that shows us, though, the meaning of the cross for the Orthodox is that the cross is not a legal thing that frees us from some offense against God.
That's coming up a bit later in our broadcast, and I encourage you to grab your Bible, have it handy, along with perhaps a highlighter and a pencil and some paper. You're going to want to take notes. First, we're going to talk about the persecution of Christians around the world, something that is happening all the time, but we don't hear much about it.
So people don't like to hear unfortunate news unless it's something that is directly correlated with home. If it's a riot that takes place in your home, you want to hear it. But it just feels so far away for people in the U.S. They can't imagine it. You know, there's no sense of global activity. And so the media goes where the money is. And people aren't interested in hearing it, so the media doesn't report it.
And they get it.
The persecution of Christians, not just here at home, but around the world. And those stories that aren't always in the news. That's coming up on today's broadcast. Welcome to another edition of Come Receive the Light from the Orthodox Christian Network on the web at myocn.net. That's myocn.net. I'm Mike Trout, and our host is Father Christopher Metropoulos, the founder of this ministry and the president of Hellenic College and Holy Cross Greek Orthodox School of Theology. So glad you could join us for what I consider a very deep broadcast, deep in many ways, as you will find out, I believe. If you'd like to hear this program again, you can do so on the web at myocn.net. Just click on the Listen button and let your friends know that we're on the air or here on the web, and encourage them to listen. And, of course, let us know that you've tuned in. That is such a great encouragement. Here with our first set of deep thoughts is our host, Father Chris.
Some have said that Christians have been persecuted more this century than any other. In some countries, it's the little things like public prayer or displays of faith. In other countries, it's a matter of life or even death. We've invited Sandra Elliott with the International Christian Concern to talk about their work and the global persecution of Christians in modern times. Welcome, Sandra.
Yeah, hi, thanks for having me.
Great to have you on. You know, in the gospel, Christ made it clear to follow him. And for some, that meant even to death. For many Christians, this was an early church problem. But in the news and social media outlets, I think you know, we're out finding out that this is still true even today. So let's talk about the percentage of the world that is experiencing Christian persecution, because we don't hear that from the media out there at this point.
No, we really don't, which is unfortunate. But the percentage of the world experiencing persecution in general right now is about 75%, according to the Pew Research Center in D.C. That's not only Christians, but people living in countries with religious restrictions, about 75%. But then, according to the U.S. State Department, Christianity specifically is being persecuted in over 60 countries in the world right now.
Well, that's amazing. And where is that persecution the most violent that you know of?
Definitely the most violent is North Korea, for obvious reasons, being a hermit kingdom founded in state ideology. Any other thought process is seen as a threat. But also in countries like Iraq and Syria, where we're seeing Christian genocide right now, actually, because of terrorist groups like ISIS. But then also in countries such as Eritrea, which would be maybe a little lesser known, you just have government persecution in Pakistan and Somalia. Those are really the hot spots. Actually, there is something called the World Watch List, where you can see in order where the highest rates of persecution are found today.
Now, if we go just for a moment to North Korea, because it is so isolated and such a closed kingdom, we very, very rarely hear of what's going on. And yet you're saying that we know that that is one of the worst areas just because of the ideology that is put forward. Is that correct?
Yes, that's correct. So most of what we know from North Korea comes from defectors. So people who have escaped the country either to China or to South Korea, or those who have escaped directly to the Western world like the U.S., we hear their testimonies, we hear their stories. I mean, it's heart-wrenching, especially from the Christian perspective, where Christians really are seen as a direct threat to the state. The state operates under something called Juche, it's J-U-C-H-E, in which the state is a provider of all necessities in life, including spiritual serenity. So any religion is really counter Korea, in their opinion.
You have to wonder how long that's going to last. My goodness. But as we can see from whatever television cameras are allowed to go in there, it is an awful situation where people have to smile all the time and do what they do. It's really tragic.
Absolutely.
International Christian Concern is more than a lobby group. You feature advocacy, awareness, and assistance. Can you tell us a little bit more about some of the ministries under the umbrella of advocacy?
Absolutely. So basically, as with most organizations, when we come across issues of persecution in which the U.S. government could possibly have a direct effect, we go directly to the U.S. government. So we can connect with congressmen, the State Department, or any other key persons that might be able to apply international pressure on the country in which the human rights offenses are taking place. So along with that, there's also a sense of cultivating relationships with other religious freedom groups so we can work together. ICC is not intent on tackling worldwide persecution by ourselves, so we partner with other organizations doing similar work.
It amazes me how, no matter what media you follow at this point, whether it's a fair and balanced approach or the so-called liberal media, I hear very, very little about Christian persecution. Recently, we were involved in the visit of Pope Francis and Patriarch Bartholomew to Jerusalem, commemorating the 50th anniversary of the lifting of the anathemas on one church on another. And when we were doing the commentary in English, we said, you know, these two men represent, 20% of the world's population. And they come together, and you hear about it for a while, and then it just goes poof, it doesn't exist anymore. And yet you see Christians being persecuted. Nobody talks about it. I mean, have we gone that far from a Judeo-Christian basis of civilization to come to the point where not even life matters anymore? What do you think?
I would say, yeah. I think part of that has to do also with just the culture we live in today. So people don't like to hear unfortunate news unless it's something that is directly correlated with home. If it's a riot that takes place in your home, you want to hear it. But it just feels so far away for people in the U.S. They can't imagine it. As far as most citizens of the U.S. are concerned, Christianity is a dominant, you know, religion in the world. And, you know, Muslims are really persecuted more so than Christians, because in the world we live in, on this side of the ocean, that may be true. But, you know, there's no sense of global activity. And so the media goes where the money is, and people aren't interested in hearing it, so the media doesn't report it.
And they get it. Well, are there times, and I guess this question falls beautifully there, are there times that ICC has made a big difference in people's lives and in human rights?
Absolutely. Under the umbrella of advocacy, actually, of December last year, there were 7 evangelical pastors in the Chiapas state of Mexico that were arrested, and upon hearing this, we were able to make contact with the IRF ambassador at large, David Saperstein, who then contacted the State Department, which responded to us within an hour, saying that the U.S. Embassy in Mexico was conducting investigations, and they were released very shortly after. So that's one of the ways where you can see kind of the lateral effect of just talking to the right people, and the U.S. was able to apply the pressure in that situation to let these men go. And then, you know, the longer term advocacy efforts would be like the U.S. Embassy in Cairo, because of pressure from Christian organizations like ICC, has really developed a relationship with the Coptic community in Egypt. You know, most people don't think of Christianity as being abundant in Egypt, but it's 10% of the population, and they are vastly, vastly persecuted. So now that we have the U.S. Embassy in Egypt paying attention to that, we really can hear more about it and do more about it.
Okay. Let me ask you one final question, and I know our listeners are going to want to find out. How can our listeners learn more about your organization?
Go to our website. It's the 21st century, and most of what we do is online. So if you go to persecution.org, there's actually a tab that says, how can you help? And under that tab, you can sign up for our email updates. You can sign up for our newsletter. You can get you know, little prayer cards, knowing exactly what needs to be prayed for in the world. Just pay attention to these things and get involved. Volunteer with organizations like ICC or Voice of the Martyrs, and share this information on your social media, because as it is today, most people get their news from social media outlets.
Mm-hmm. Yes, they do. All right, Sandra, thank you very much for being on the program today.
Thank you so much.
And all of that follow-up information will be on our website at myocn.net. That's myocn.net. I love what Sandra said there toward the end. Just pay attention and get involved. If you're interested in this incredible opportunity to touch people around the world, then follow up with International Christian Concern, or as Sandra called it, ICC. This is Come Receive the Light from the Orthodox Christian Network. I'm Mike Trout. Our host is Father Christopher Metropoulos. We're a nonprofit outreach. And speaking of getting involved, we would appreciate your involvement with this ministry, perhaps on a regular monthly basis. Go to our website at myocn.net and click on the Donate button and find out more. That's myocn.net. And now with our feature conversation, here again is Father Chris.
Please join me in welcoming James Kelly to the program today. He's here to talk to us about Christology. Welcome to the show, James.
Thank you, Father. I'm glad to be here.
Let's start out by defining the word Christology. What are we talking about here?
Right. Well, in my work, I use the term Christology to mean a particular individual's or group's teaching about Christ and his incarnation. I think that's kind of the standard textbook, you know, definition.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And so when you're speaking about Christ, obviously we're talking about serious theology here, but why is it important for each of our listeners?
Well, I'll answer in a way that I would think Father John Romanides, who I wrote the book about, would answer that question. Christology is important because if we do not follow the correct teachings about Christ, then we have no way of being united to Christ. Mm. And if we look carefully at the history of the Church, most of the heresies, most of the teachings that that deviate from the Orthodox tradition, either directly or indirectly, are based upon misunderstandings of the dogma about Christ. So I think that illustrates the importance of Christology.
Okay. And from my knowledge, I know that there are two approaches, a theology of glory, a theology of the cross. Can you explain that a bit to us?
Right. Yes, that is something that I'm glad I have the opportunity to explain, because in the first chapter of my book on Father John, I go into this particular meeting, this particular conference of the World Council of Churches, which Father John attended. It was in, I think, Bucharest. And the whole topic, there were some Protestants there were some Lutherans there, and the whole topic was theology of the cross versus the theology of glory. And I didn't go into this much in the book, but that comes from Martin Luther, who had a sermon called Two Kinds of Righteousness. Mm-hmm. And in that writing, and plus many other places, Luther distinguished between a theology of the cross, which he claimed to follow, and then a theology of glory. And the whole point of it is that Luther believed that we should focus only on the cross as the source of every good for man. And Luther also derided what he termed the theology of glory, which he was a pejorative term for him. Mm-hmm. And it's important to note that no one at that time walked around calling himself a theologian of glory. And I don't know of anyone who would claim to be one, at least the way that Luther describes a theologian of glory. But the term indicated for him any theology that believed man could do anything that was not depraved and evil. Now, to rephrase that, Luther believed if you thought you could do anything at all to help your condition at all in any sense of the word, then you were a theologian of glory, a watered-down, you know, Lutheran or Protestant, and that you were wrong. So, you know, it's an extreme view, like we could probably come to expect from Luther, if anyone's read his writings, is that it just seems to get more and more, he has no patience with those who are around him. Even the other Protestants are not Protestant enough for him. So he says, you guys are theologians of glory. You think that man can do something about his plight, however small, but I believe you can do nothing but look at the cross. So I thought that I might also have a word about the Orthodox teaching on glory and cross. May I do that for a moment?
Of course. Please go ahead.
Glory is a technical biblical term, which for the Orthodox means the uncreated energies of God. In Greek, it's doxa, and in Hebrew, it's even in the Old Testament, in many places, it's shekinah, mm-hmm. and it means the resplendence or light of God. It's what's shown from Moses' face And later on Mount Tabor, it showed from Christ, Moses, and Elijah's face, showing that it is the one revelation of God for the Old Testament and the New Testament for all time. It's God's glory that saves man and that visits man. And so I would say that for the Orthodox, the glory is the love, life, and presence of God that comes down directly into the heart of man. And that shows us, though, the meaning of the cross for the Orthodox is that the cross is not a legal thing that frees us from some offense against God.
Mm-hmm. Well, I have to tell you, James, I've heard a lot of speakers before, but you just took probably 2 semesters of my systematic theology class and squished it into a paragraph and made it perfectly easy for me to understand. And I'm sure you've made it easy for our listeners to understand also. Let's just talk for a minute about some of these underlying issues with Christology, because many theologians worldwide will be teaching us different things, and many times it's very difficult to understand these terms and this level of theology. For example, Western theologians argue that the created world is governed by natural laws that correspond to God's moral laws. Can you explain that for us a little bit?
I say Western, I'm going to use the term Western. By that, I just mean non-Orthodox Christian theology,
okay.
And so I think I have to generalize a little bit and just say Western to mean non-Orthodox theology.
Okay.
But there is kind of, a method to that kind of theology, which most Protestants and Roman Catholics would readily admit is their specific approach, and it would be based in all or some on Blessed Augustine of Hippo and his specific approach to theology. And I wanted to say a few things about that, if I could. According to this approach, they view God as having changed his disposition to man after the fall. So when Adam fell, the view in the West, which it differs, there's exceptions, but the main view is that God went from love to disappointment or hate or some other feeling toward man.
After the fall.
After the fall,
okay.
Right. And so that's why there has to be a big atonement or a big cross event where there's a satisfaction of this wrath of God or this displeasure or turning away from man.
Mm-hmm.
So at this point, of course, we Orthodox throw up our hands and say that, you know, God loves all, you know, exactly.
Where did they
the same.
Find that disposition issue? I mean, that God's disposition would have changed. Where do you think that came from?
Well, actually, yeah, I'm glad that you mentioned that, because Father John's early writings, which is what Realism of Glory, my book, is about, it's about the first 5 years of Father John's writings, and Father John pinpointed it as Blessed Augustine, in his writings, he didn't seem to understand or know much of anything about that theology of glory that we touched on before.
Mm-hmm.
And so the thing about the theology of glory is that the glory there is the power of God, which allows us to resist the power of the devil.
Mm-hmm.
And without the understanding of the theology of glory, you're sort of powerless against what the demons can do to you, what the dark forces can do. You don't have any weapons against it. So according to Father John, when Augustine looked at all of these things, he saw something quite different. He didn't think about the methodology of fighting the demons. He didn't have any way of looking at the methods of the saints. If you look at the lives of the saints and the things that they did to overcome the demons, Saint Anthony and all of those things, you know, you didn't really have that kind of an approach. So what you did was you looked, Augustine rather, looked at satisfying some kind of legal thing.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
It was some kind of, one thing happened, so God has to even it out.
Sort of a contract.
It was more of a contract thing, and I'm sure, you know, in your theological education that they showed this as one of the differences.
Mm-hmm.
So that's one of the big differences there, and so that kind of takes the place, and it's not so much more about changing the inner man, you don't have to conform yourself to God in this Western view. You know, you have to change God's mind about something. So it seems, you know, at least to the Orthodox, it seems a little bit different.
Okay. And you've also said, since you touched on the issue of demonology or Satan, let's look at this for a minute. You've said that you can't make sense of Christology without an understanding of demonology of Satan. So what's our Orthodox understanding of that, taking off from what you said before?
Absolutely, yes. The demonological issue is very important. Well, Father John's early work, which is what my book is about, is very eloquent on that subject. Father John believed that Western Augustinian theology's most tragic feature is its downplaying of asceticism, what we spoke of just a little earlier.
Yes.
And Father John defined asceticism as unremitting war against Satan and his minions. But to get more specific, I wanted to talk about an early writing that kind of illustrates this. There was an early church writing called The Shepherd of Hermas, and it was a writing that St. Athanasius was very fond of. And he said in this writing that inside of man, there's a good and a bad thought. It's within man's heart. And close to these two thoughts, there's a good and a bad power. And likewise, over these thoughts and powers, good and bad, there's a good and a bad angel watching over each one. So I think that if we look at that as kind of how the early church writers thought of things, it's very physical. It's very physiological. You know, there's a war going on inside man, and you have to very physically fight against it.
Okay.
So I think that that's the focus of the early church and the Orthodox of all different eras, is that there's kind of the stranglehold of death that's hanging over man, but he can get out of it, but only through the church and only through this kind of ascetic war against the demons. It sounds kind of dramatic, but I think that's the point.
No, but let's tie that directly to the Christology that we've been talking about. I mean, overcoming the fear of Satan as a prerequisite for membership in the church. Let's talk about that for a minute.
Well, that's a great point, because I can imagine people that aren't familiar with Orthodoxy hearing this and thinking, well, it's about individualism. It's about someone just going off by themselves and doing this, you know, doing this thing inside only. Mm-hmm. But, you know, actually, of course, Father John and the entire Orthodox tradition stresses that, you know, the devil can only be defeated through individual and corporate asceticism. So that means the sacraments of the church, and that means, you know, spiritual fatherhood. You have your father confessor. You have your person who has experience with these issues, and then you learn from them. So it's not just you, like they say, a direct line to God. Well, there's no such thing, you know. It's always through a community that you worship correctly.
You're speaking about an overemphasis of individual salvation versus the corporate salvation or the communal salvation?
Absolutely, yes.
Okay. I mean, your book on Christology focuses on, obviously, we talked about it, the views of Protopresbyter John Romanidis of blessed memory, who had an image of God theology. Explain that for us a little bit.
Well, the Bible, of course, in Genesis, we're all familiar with the quotation there about man being made according to the image. And there's an Orthodox theology of being in the image and likeness of God, man, that is. And also, of course, you know, non-Orthodox Christians are also going to write about this because it is in a prominent, you know, place in the Bible. Mm-hmm. But I would say that for the Orthodox, the image of God in man is really his spiritual center. It's his heart, which is actually a technical term. It's used in the Old and New Testaments over 900 times. But the Orthodox have a very specific meaning for that because it's man's receptor of the glory of God. Basically, it has a special capacity, the heart that is, of man, to receive the glory of God, and it makes man become like God. But I think the most important part of that teaching is that it takes God's initiative, but we have to accept that, and we have something that we have to do as well. Mm-hmm. So it doesn't come in on one side or the other, like maybe some of the Western theology seems to do, saying that God does it all or man has to do it all. It's a meeting point. It's a synergy between the two.
Okay. And one of the things, I've been wanting to ask you this, because one of the things that Father Romanidis said was that Christ was born sinless and without deficiency.
Mm-hmm.
But he still advanced and was perfected over the course of his life on earth. Now, how can something that's born without sin be perfected? I mean, he started out perfect, didn't he?
Yeah, that is absolutely correct. But for the Orthodox, there are levels of perfection. In heaven, for example, the Lord's house has many rooms or mansions, as it's often translated. And one of my mentors, Dr. Joseph P. Farrell, showed in his book on St. Maximos that the Augustinian view is that a choice or fork in the existential road is always between a good and an evil option. However, the Orthodox believe that in heaven there will be an infinite number of choices, all of which are good, since we can never circumscribe or enjoy all of the divine energies. And likewise, Christ by will, not by nature, but by will, took on blameless passions and weaknesses like, you know, hunger, thirst, and the natural fear of death. But he took those on by will in order to change those into our salvation and to allow us a way not to be held down by them.
Mm-hmm.
So therefore, if he did, you know, begin in a level that he could progress. He didn't do it because he needed to do it. And it wasn't a progression from imperfection or a defect, but it was him following the correct course of human life so that he could redeem it. And that's the only reason why that you could say that he moved from a lesser perfection to a greater perfection. Notice I didn't say a defect, from a perfection to a perfection.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And I think that maybe, you know, preserves the paradox that we have to preserve in Christology of, yes, he progresses, no, he doesn't, both things.
Okay. And when did Father John fall asleep in the Lord, do you know?
The year 2001.
2001. It was rather recent, I remember that much.
Yes, definitely.
Well, Father John also talked about another thing here, was shared error in non-Orthodox Christologies. Which is the idea that an uncreated God can't be united with human nature. Now, can you explain that and what that means?
Right, yeah, absolutely. I cover that in the second part of my book. It's the second section of the book, Realism of Glory. And I'll try to explain that. Basically, there was an approach to Christology in the West which believed that God could do nothing by nature that was good. He could only do things by will that would have a good effect. And so there came to be this idea that God cannot touch anything by his nature. And there was no conception of what we talked about before, the glory.
Mm-hmm.
There was just the idea of like a created presence that could somehow touch creation.
Okay.
So I think as an Orthodox, you can see right away the difficulties with that, because we would believe that God directly sustains everything, and that when we look at Christ, he directly came down as a man, and his human body becomes a source of not created graces, we would never say that, but uncreated glory and grace actually emanates from the human body. It's the only created thing that actually exudes uncreatedness or uncreated glory would be the body of Christ, and this teaching is completely absent from the other theologians that I spoke of. They would say created tokens or created things would come to be that would give us concepts.
Mm-hmm.
And that would be just as far as you possibly can get from, you know, what the Orthodox would be behind.
Well, James, I want to thank you for joining us today from Oklahoma, actually mm-hmm. from Norman, Oklahoma, which is where you live. And thank you so much for taking the time to explain this to us. Listeners, James' book is called A Realism of Glory, Lectures on Christology in the Works of Proto-Presbyter John Romanidis. Purchase a book today on our website at myocn.net. Thank you again, James.
Thank you, Father.
When you do go to our website at myocn.net, on the right side, I believe, there is an icon that you can click on, which takes you to our bookstore, and that will actually link you through to Amazon. And as I've said so many times, any purchase you make when you access Amazon through our website, myocn.net, generates a donation back to this ministry. It's a wonderful way to support the work of the Orthodox Christian Network. I'm Mike Trout. Our host each week is Father Christopher Metropoulos. We'll be back next week with another edition of Come Receive the Light. In the meantime, remember to always be discerning and have faith in what you listen to.